Welcome, counsel. Please enter your appearances.
Good morning, Your Honor. Sarah Spencer with the law firm of Christensen & Jensen on behalf of the appellant Greyhound Lines, Incorporated.
Scott Peterson, and I've got David Kelly, my partner from Fagan & Clendenin. We've got Robert Hughes, who is senior counsel for United or Utah Transit Authority on behalf of the appellant.
Thank you. And Ms. Spencer, you're reserving how much time?
I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the court. This case is about two sophisticated business entities who extensively negotiated an arm's length transaction that resulted in a commercial lease agreement. And this case calls upon the court to determine the interplay between indemnification and insurance provisions in that commercial lease agreement, and specifically the question of whether Utah law requires an expression of clear and unequivocal intent for one party to procure insurance or provide self-insurance for another party's negligence. We submit that the district court's ruling granting summary judgment in favor of UTA and its construction of the lease agreement should be reversed for three independent reasons. First of all, no matter what rule of construction applies, whether it's regular rules of contract interpretation or a rule of strict construction, the claim at issue in this case did not arise from Greyhound's use, occupancy, maintenance, and operations under the lease agreement for the principal reason that UTA admits its sole negligence caused the claim to occur.
As I understand it, Ms. Spencer, if that language had appeared in a CGL policy itself, then that assertion that you just made would be incorrect. In other words, as that language is used in commercial liability insurance, arises out of, simply means in a but-for sense, and there is a but-for connection. Do you agree with that?
Your Honor, I agree that there is case law that construes the language arising from within the context of a CGL policy, but that's not the issue before the court for a couple reasons. Principally, the lease agreement at issue specifically gave Greyhound the right to act in a self-insured capacity, to pay claims from its own working capital, from its own funds.
Sure, but the principal duty is to provide insurance, and the idea that there's a alternative opportunity to self-insure seems like not the right way to think about it. The question is how to interpret language obligating a party to secure insurance, right? And if that language has well-established meaning in the insurance field, to not follow the established meaning in the insurance field seems difficult.
Well, I disagree, Your Honor, for a couple reasons. First of all, this is not an insurance contract. This is an agreement that was negotiated at arm's length, extensively negotiated between two sophisticated business entities.
But it was an agreement to procure insurance.
Right.
And so the equivalency of the insurance procured and the asserted right, obviously, to self-insure, don't they need to be equivalent?
Well, I disagree, Your Honor, because of the language, the express language of paragraph 10H, subparagraph 1, that governs third-party liability. There is express language in that paragraph that limits Greyhound's obligation to insure or to procure insurance. The agreement does not state that Greyhound was obligated to insure UTA for every claim that arises physically within the intermodal hub or every claim that arose from UTA's own breaches of its express obligations, its express undertakings in the lease agreement. Instead, it contains a limitation. It's very limited.
Let me ask you a hypothetical, Ms. Spencer. Let's say that Greyhound actually did secure a CGL policy and it included language exactly like this language here, arising out of its use and operations of the intermodal hub, and the same accident happens, and UTA gets sued, and UTA says to Greyhound, we want to submit this to the insurer that you've secured. And Greyhound's response is, oh, no, I'm not going to allow that because this didn't, in approximate way,
arise out of our use. It was proximately connected to UTA's negligence. Would that work? Where you've actually got a CGL policy that includes this language, wouldn't UTA be entitled to avail itself of the policy?
Well, there are two reasons why I think that that issue is not before the court.
No, I know. That's why I said it's a hypothetical. Well, so in that hypothetical, how does that hypothetical come out?
Well, Your Honor, the difficulty I have with answering that question is that that's not in the record. It hasn't been argued in terms of what a CGL policy would actually provide for in this instance.
So that's why I'm trying to give you some detail in my hypothetical. Hypotheticals, I think, sort of help us understand the issues. And so the hypothetical is the CGL policy mimics the language in the contract, and everything else in the case is the same. Does Greyhound get to say, no, we're not going to allow you, UTA, to avail yourself of the policy?
Well, perhaps in the hypothetical Your Honor has offered, it would be the insurance company that has been paid premiums to cover the risk that it agreed to insure, which is only the risk for claims arising from the tenant's use, occupancy, maintenance, and operations, that would be asserting the same arguments that Greyhound is now arguing before the court.
Okay, fair enough. So does the insurance company get to get off on that basis? Because I really doubt it in light of the language that we were talking about earlier, that Justice Durham and I were talking about earlier, which says this is how to understand CGL insurance language. Arises out of means but for. So I think the insurance company loses in that hypothetical, right?
I would not concede that, Your Honor, because I believe that it's a different circumstance. That's not what the issues are in this case. Greyhound is being sued for an alleged failure to provide self-insurance or procure insurance for claims that arise from its use, occupancy, maintenance, and operations. So whether or not a CGL insurer in that instance would be able to make the same arguments, I don't believe that it changes the outcome, because the fact remains this claim resulted from UTA's negligence.
So, before Justice Lee jumped in, you were about to announce the limitation here on the obligation to procure insurance, and I wanted to hear what you were going to characterize the limitation as.
Well, the limitation is set forth in the express language on record sites R102. Greyhound is only obligated to procure insurance or to self-insure for claims that relate to its own activities, its own conduct under the lease agreement.
And where in the lease agreement is that found? Is that
that's
under subsection 1?
Yes, subsection 1 of paragraph 10H regarding third-party liability insurance. Now, these are sophisticated business entities. If UTA and Greyhound had intended that the insurance obligation would cover all claims, no matter the cause, including claims relating to UTA's specific undertakings in the lease agreement.
Let me ask you about the meaning of the first sentence of subparagraph G, which requires that the tenant shall not permit the premises or common areas to be used for any purpose which would render the insurance thereon void. Now that, it seems to me, is clearly for the protection of UTA, not Greyhound, which suggests that the insurance requirement was always intended to be equivalent to ordinary liability insurance and protecting all named parties for liability. So do you have some other explanation for paragraph G?
I believe that paragraph addresses circumstances where Greyhound elected to buy insurance rather than to act in a self-insured capacity as it did, and perhaps a circumstance where it did not pay the premium and that would render the insurance canceled.
Well, no, this says, this doesn't have anything to do with paying premiums. It has to do with the use to which the property is put. It just seems to me, I'm getting back to this notion that Greyhound's obligation to purchase, to insure, meant that there had to be an equivalency between self-insurance and a purchase policy which named UTA as a covered party.
That may be so, Your Honor, but even if Greyhound had procured insurance from a third-party liability insurer, this limitation that's expressed in paragraph 10H, subparagraph 1, would still be dispositive of this appeal. The question is whether this claim arose from tenants' use, occupancy, maintenance, and operations.
So let me ask you another question about that subsection 1 that talks about the insurance. After it says that may arise from tenants' use, occupancy, or maintenance, or operations, then there's a sentence that says, whether performed by tenant itself, any subcontractor, or anyone directly or indirectly employed by either of them. When I read that last part of the sentence, whether performed by tenant, a subcontractor, or either one of them, it suggests to me that the policy would be limited to insuring claims that arise from actions of Greyhound or its subcontractors. Am I reading that correctly?
Absolutely, Your Honor. That is our reading of this provision. And clearly, these sophisticated entities, nothing stopped them from including language right here in this paragraph that said, this insurance obligation is intended to cover not only tenants' activities under the lease agreement, but also landlords' activities.
But if arises out of means in a but-for sense, then clearly there is an arises out of connection to Greyhound's use and occupancy of the premises, right? Because it's Greyhound's passenger that was injured here.
Your Honor, there's
so this really just goes back to that question, right? Does arises out of mean proximate cause or does it mean but for? Isn't that really the core issue?
I think that is really the core issue, Your Honor, and we've cited the court to case law. In fact, a case decided by this court that we submit is on all fours as to that issue and the meaning of the words arising from.
Do you have any cases involving commercial general liability insurance in which arises out of was interpreted in a proximate cause sort of sense?
We've cited cases to the court in the context of automobile insurance policies. There was a case we cited
So is the answer to my question no?
I cannot cite a case to Your Honor as I stand here right now regarding commercial general liability insurance, but I don't think that affects the outcome. And I don't think it means the district court shouldn't be reversed because this is not a policy of insurance. This is an arm's length, fully negotiated commercial lease agreement.
Don't you think that if you're UTA and you signed a lease agreement obligating Greyhound to purchase commercial general liability insurance and the lease agreement uses language that has settled meaning with respect to commercial general liability, that you'd expect that it would be parallel with that kind of language?
Well, I disagree, Your Honor, because the law also permits my client, Greyhound, to assume that UTA would do two things. To assume that it would not be negligent, as the common law requires it to abide by reasonable care, and to assume that it would honor its obligations under the lease agreement.
But the problem with insurance is that it contains none of those assumptions.
But, Your Honor, this is not an insurance policy.
No, I understand, but it is an agreement. The lease agreement obligates the procurement of insurance.
Or the provision of self-insurance.
Right, but again, the question is whether they should be equivalent.
Whether it's self-insurance and a commercial general liability policy.
In other words, wasn't UTA negotiating for its protection? And wasn't it shifting the burden under the lease to Greyhound to ensure that not just Greyhound, but that the landlord, UTA, was similarly protected for liability issues, which it would have received under a CGL policy?
I disagree, Your Honor, for two reasons. The case that I touched on held that the language arising from can mean something more than but-for causation. There can be events, occurrences, that cut off the chain of causation. And in the Union Pacific case, it was the indemnity's own negligence. But the second reason that I don't think they should be construed the same is because we have a contract where the parties have undertaken very specific allocations of liability and risk. And I would direct the court to UTA's indemnification promise, which is on R-105, it's in paragraph 11. And UTA, in effect, agreed to insure and defend and hold my client harmless from claims arising from its negligence and willful undertaking.
Here's the way Greyhound make the same indemnification the other way.
They were mutual
indemnifications. So by this logic, even if this is confined to liability for Greyhound's conduct, that indemnification would trump that obligation to procure insurance.
I'm not sure I'm following Your Honor's question, but it is true that Greyhound undertook indemnity promises in the agreement.
I guess the point I'm trying to make is I understand your argument to be that this policy, the fact that UTAA agreed to indemnify.
Well, not only to indemnify, own, but to seek harmless and defend.
For its own negligence and to seek harmless. Demonstrates that this liability, this obligation to procure, did not extend to insurance for UTA's own negligence, correct?
That is correct, Your
okay,
Honor.
Okay, so and what I'm saying is Greyhound also had a reciprocal indemnity obligation, yet you would concede that this clause included an obligation for Greyhound to procure insurance against its own negligence on behalf of UTA, correct?
I would agree that if the claim arose from Greyhound's negligence, then insurance would be owed.
But why was it necessary if there was this indemnification agreement on Greyhound's part? Why would the liability insurance be necessary?
Well, I don't agree that necessarily the insurance would cover the indemnity promise. I think that they are separate in and of themselves, but I do think that they have to be read together, and that is the argument that we've asserted, Your Honor, is that paragraph 10, governing insurance, and paragraph 11, governing indemnification, have to be read in harmony and in a way that gives mutual effect under this Court's well-accepted rules of contract interpretation. And if UTA contention is correct, that Greyhound owes insurance no matter the cause, then in effect this provision, UTA's promise to save, defend, and hold harmless my client when it breaches the lease and when it is negligent, that provision of the contract is essentially rendered meaningless.
Would that be the case if there is a claim in excess of these liability limits?
Well,
I mean, cannot these clauses coexist? Are they not reconcilable on that ground?
Isn't that the whole point of having indemnity on top of insurance, is that to the extent the insurance doesn't cover you, you've got an indemnity. That's exactly the way I was thinking about it, what Chief Justice Durant said.
But that is not what this contract says, Your Honor. Paragraph 11, nowhere does it state that there's any sort of sequential preference or that the indemnity promise only comes into play when insurance either doesn't cover or it's been exhausted.
But that's how to credit both clauses, right? I mean, we've got to give credit to both of the provisions in the lease agreement, and that's how to do so, isn't it?
Well, I disagree, Judge, for the reason that this paragraph is not limited to indemnification only in instances where excess, where the claim goes above the available amount.
But there's no need for indemnification unless
right. The
claim goes above the amount that's covered by insurance.
But that conclusion...
So the clause doesn't even come into play until you've got that gap.
But that conclusion assumes a sequential preference in favor of the insurance clause before the indemnification provision.
Well, but there's all... You always have to assume a preference to recover from insurance before you recover from any other source, including indemnity, don't you? That's the way the world works.
Well, I disagree, Your Honor, for the reason that this contract permitted Greyhound to act in a self-insured capacity, which is a materially distinct circumstance than simply procuring a policy. And I see that my time is out, but this does lead me to the final issue I wanted to touch upon, which is that the law should recognize a rule of strict construction for promises to procure insurance, especially where the contract permits the indemnifying or insuring party to act in a self-insured capacity. And we've cited the cases to the court, including this court's own case in Freund versus Utah.
Now, I have to say I disagree with you that Freund settles this question.
And we recognize that there's some lack of clarity regarding...
it's not lack of clarity. The court just didn't reach the holding that you assert.
And that's why we submit that irrespective of Freund, that rule is still well-reasoned and should be adopted based on the fact that, as the court, the Tenth Circuit and Kennicott recognized, where the agreement to procure insurance is, in effect, an agreement to indemnify, like it is here, where Greyhound acts in a self-insured capacity, the law requires a statement of clear and unequivocal intent, which the trial court found is not present and which that ruling has not been appealed. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Spencer. Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Peterson, could you go to section H1 of the contract, and tell me if I'm misreading it when I read the last part of that provision, whether performed by tenant, any subcontractor, or anyone directly or indirectly employed by either of them. Doesn't that last clause limit the obligation to procure insurance to insurance that arises from essentially the actions of Greyhound or its subcontractors?
By saying from the actions, I'm assuming that Your Honor is suggesting that there is some sort of causal relationship, approximate cause concept to that language. Is that what you're getting at, Your Honor?
Well, I it just seems to me that that language limits Greyhound's obligation to procure liability insurance to procuring a liability insurance policy that covers actions that arise from breaches by Greyhound or its subcontractors.
Let me explain why that language does not essentially require that the loss be caused by Greyhound or its tenants or subcontractors. This, when you look at the lease agreement in total, and there are references in it, a very classic reference is just in the recitals. This lease agreement contemplated multiple tenants at the intermodal hub. So it was not that you would find only UTA there and Greyhound. If you look at the very first recital, at the first page of the lease agreement, it notes that the purpose of the facility was for use as an intermodal transportation facility to accommodate commuter rail, light rail, local bus, passenger rail, intercity passenger bus, and other transit providers. So, and there are other references in Section 1B, in Section 20B, that reference other tenants, co-tenants with Greyhound. So what does that do for your question? What that means is the arising out of or the rising from language of Section 10H1, it shows that the insurance Greyhound was required to procure was to cover losses that were connected to, in a but-for sense, activities that Greyhound or its subcontractors or employees were engaged in.
So, Mr. Peterson, are you suggesting that that language is an expansion then, not a limitation, expansion of who's subject to?
That's right. So, actually, it's both, Your Honor. In the first portion, the arising from tenants' use occupancy is saying it's Greyhound's activities, not some light rail tenants' activities.
And does Greyhound. It just apply to property damage, or does it apply? I mean, when I first read that sentence, I thought that it meant the policy shall protect landlord from liabilities and claims for damages, personal injury, bodily injury, including accidental death, essentially, period, colon, and from claims for property damage that may arise from tenants' use occupancy. Is that what you're
That's
arguing
not
here?
Our reading. It certainly does. I could see Your Honor's interpretation of that. But what we see this as, and to go back to Justice Simonis's point, the first portion, it's limiting in that it relates to Greyhound's activities. But it's expanding in that it doesn't just include Greyhound, but Greyhound and its subcontractors and anyone directly or indirectly employed by either of them.
But the key is arises from, right? And
yes.
That arises from has a but-for meaning in CGL parlance.
That's right. It's very clear. There are some other key phrases and words in Section 10H1 that support the concept that arising from it has a but-for a connotation and not approximate cause. For example, when you look at 10H, the very first section, it says that Greyhound, the tenant in Section H, at its own cost and expense, shall secure and maintain minimum insurance coverage. So the implication of those words are that it's insurance. We're not talking about indemnification or indemnity requirements, insurance coverage. Then we move to Section 1 and the first sentence, commercial general liability insurance.
That has a meaning to not just people, but businesses. Commercial general liability is the type of insurance that covers businesses by this every day, that covers premises liability. It's the personal injury, bodily injury claims that are covered under a typical commercial general liability insurance policy. The language goes on to say that Greyhound is required to have UTA named as an additional insured. When somebody is named as an insured, whether you're a person or a business, the assumption, the presumption is, I am covered for my own negligent acts. Why else would UTA want to be a named insured if it was not to protect UTA from its own acts?
How does that construction not just immunize your client from performing all of its obligations under Section 12 of the lease? Can't your client just say, well, I guess we really don't need to clear any snow. We really don't need to do anything we've been obligated to do because we've got this insurance policy that will immunize us from any liability for these breaches.
Yeah, and that's an argument that Greyhound has been making consistently. The problem with that argument is that the contract has some express language that allows Greyhound, if it feels like UTA isn't doing proper snow removal or is not doing proper maintenance or repair, to, and this is Section 30 of the lease, if Greyhound finds that UTA fails to perform any of the covenants and conditions under the lease, then Greyhound can take those obligations onto itself, perform the obligations like snow removal or maintenance of a sidewalk, and then give the bill to UTA. And Section 30 says it shall be immediately due and payable by the defaulting party. So this did not leave Greyhound without a remedy. Greyhound had a remedy in contract. It could sue UTA for breach of contract for failing to fulfill its obligations under the lease agreement. And moreover, specifically, it could have remedied the situation itself. In fact, in an earlier provision in the lease, Greyhound is obligated to inform UTA if it notices something awry, either something's fallen into disrepair or that it was non-conforming. It is required to notify UTA so that UTA can go in and fix it.
And in fact, the limitation that insurance limitation would not protect Greyhound if its actions caused a claim in excess of the policy limits as well, too, right?
That's,
so it's still liable.
That's right. Well, so if there's a claim either in excess of the liability limits of the required insurance or outside the coverage of that insurance, the parties would then have to revert to Section 11, which is the indemnification provision.
Is that the only application of Section 11? I was trying to understand the interaction between paragraph 10H, the insurance obligation, and paragraph 11, the indemnity duty. Would the indemnity duty kick in any circumstance other than beyond policy limits or not covered by the insurance?
Well, the insurance obligations of 10H are not unlimited. I mean, it does specify the types of claims that would be covered. For example, it says personal injury claims, bodily injury claims, accidental death claims. I suppose, for example, you could have a typical type of claim could be an advertising injury type claim, or you might have a patent infringement type claim somehow that is outside of the terms of 10H. If that arose and would clearly not be covered under a commercial general liability policy, they do have plenty of limits, then the parties would revert to Section 11. So, I mean, generally speaking, and it's easy in this case because it's a typical personal injury claim, you would be looking to the parameters of the CGL policy, but there are clearly circumstances that could arise outside of both the liability limits and also the scope of coverage of such a policy where the parties would have to revert to Section 11, the indemnification. Pickover is dispositive of this issue?
Pickover is not dispositive of this issue. It's a decision of the Intermediate Court of Appeals.
That's right, Your Honor, and I didn't mean it to say...
We might want to agree with it, but we're not bound by it.
Right. What I meant to say is it was dispositive for the district court in that the Court of Appeals sure. binds the district court.
Sure.
We would encourage this court to affirm the district court's decision and to approve of the court's ruling in Pickover, including its reasoning. There is a lot of the Pickover court went into great detail to look at not only the differences between indemnification provisions and procurement of insurance provisions, but also what the court called the functional structures of both. And clearly, as I think we put out in the briefs, the history was you did not want one party indemnifying another party for its own negligence because the thought was that the person receiving that indemnity would act more carelessly. And that has essentially been rejected by the courts so long as indemnification provisions have clear and unequivocal language passing that obligation on to one party. The insurance context, however, is very different. Companies and individuals buy insurance to cover themselves for their own negligence on a daily basis. And this court, in fact, as early as in the 1980s, with the Shell Oil case, concluded that the concept that you would act more negligently if you had insurance to cover you for your own negligence had clearly been rejected by most courts, and that it really doesn't support the concept of not allowing somebody to insure for their own negligence. Pickover, therefore, points out that we don't have those structural or functional concerns when we're buying insurance, even if it's to buy it for somebody else. And moreover, a second point that Pickover found that was significant, which we would urge this court to also recognize, is when parties get together and negotiate a lease, and in this case, this is a 40-year lease between Greyhound and UTA. The relationship of the parties is long-term. We are 10 years into this lease at this point. The parties have a benefit of being able to remove from their relationship most of the personal injury, bodily injury type claims, so that the party's relationship is not disrupted by arguments, litigation, and claims that one party's negligence somehow can cause the other party to be liable. And if you look at the lease agreement, it is loaded with obligations that overlap each other. For example, the common area is generally something that UTA is obligated to maintain. However, the lease agreement also points out that Greyhound will provide the security for the common area. It also points out that UTA will provide janitorial services for the bathrooms in the main common area of the premises. So it's not like this lease agreement clearly distinguished the obligations of the parties based on a geographic line on this premises, divided between, say, the lease premises versus common area. The lease agreement does not do that. There are obligations overlapping in both areas. And because that's the case, the need for these parties to remove this concept of third-party liability from the dispute between them is significant. By requiring Greyhound to purchase insurance that would then provide general commercial liability with these limits as specified.
Mr. Spencer, there's no question about who's responsible for the act here, right?
That's at the hearing, Your Honor. That's right. I mean,
all right.
And
there's no question that Greyhound had incurred attorney's fees as a result of that negligence, right?
Well,
let's just assume that they incur some form.
They incurred fees because they defended themselves by failing.
Just follow with me for a second. Let's assume, for the purposes of this question, that Greyhound, in this case or some other case, incurs attorney's fees as a result of that. This indemnification provision would require you, whether you recover insurance or don't, to pay for those fees, correct?
If the fees were as a result of UTA's negligence,
yes,
and were otherwise not something that would have been covered under the insurance, then I think Your Honor is correct.
But you're recovering. You may be tapped. UTA may be tapped for some judgment as a result of its negligence, and it wants to be able to go to some third party and recover.
Well, that's right.
Yeah, I mean,
that's
whether right. It's whether the other party is self-insuring or has sent it out, that does, you don't care about that.
Well, no. I mean, unless Your Honor's suggesting that somehow, as co-insureds, we can sue each other for the.
No, what I'm really getting at is, isn't that another instance in which the indemnification provision and the insurance provision coexist?
That's right. That's right. The indemnification provision is essentially the default. It covers everything less what's been accepted by the insurance provision. And that insurance requirement is frankly a fairly comprehensive requirement. If you where it gets muddied is they claim that they can self-insure and that somehow by self-insuring it affords less protection to UTA. Well, that cannot be the case. And the reason it can't be the case is if you look at the very beginning of Section 10, this is Section 10A, it says for any and all types of insurance required by this lease, tenant, which is Greyhound, may satisfy its requirements through a lawfully established self-insurance program. 10A specifically allows for self-insurance, but that self-insurance must nonetheless satisfy Greyhound's requirements. And the requirements are then outlined as it relates to general liability insurance in Section 10H. So whether it self-insures or whether it buys that insurance, those protections to UTA and obligations to Greyhound are the same. They cannot be different. There's nothing in the lease indicating that there would be any difference based upon the fact that Greyhound wanted to self-insure. Unless Your Honors have anything more, I'll yield back my time.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Spencer.
Thank you, Your Honors. Greyhound is not arguing that there are different insuring obligations depending upon whether Greyhound self-insures or whether it procures liability insurance. No matter which option it chooses, the requirements are the same, and they're set forth in paragraph 10H. And I want to go back to the issue of the language arising from. If this claim had resulted from a specific activity that Greyhound agreed to undertake in its obligations under the lease agreement, we wouldn't be here today. The fact remains that it's admitted it was caused by by UTA's negligence, not Greyhound's negligence.
So it's a general liability policy. UTA is a named insured. They're protected against liability to third party. They're protected in every circumstance except the only one that seems to really matter, and that is that their exposure is for their own acts. That's their potential liability. Any vicarious exposure by virtue of Greyhound's negligence seems wholly secondary. So, I'll let you respond to that.
My response, Your Honor, is simply to refer the court back to the plain language of the agreement. It is a limitation on the instances in which insurance is owed. Conduct caused by Greyhound. Greyhound's activities and operations. And there's no
where
dispute.
Does it say that? It's conduct of bodily injury that arises out of Greyhound's use of the premises. How does this not arise out of their use? But for Greyhound's use, this doesn't happen.
Your Honor, I can't disagree with the obvious conclusion that if she had not been Greyhound's customer, she would not have been there, she would not have slipped and fallen, and this claim would not have come into being. No one can dispute that, but I refer the court back to the Union Pacific versus El Paso Railroad case, where this court said there are limitations on the scope of the language arising from. It is not merely a but-for analysis. In that case, a gas company asked the railroad company for permission to lay its gas line along the train tracks. The railroad company said, sure, you can do that as long as you indemnify us from any claims that arise from the pipeline. The gas company's employee was out in the middle of nowhere, Wyoming, going to fix the gas pipeline. But for that pipeline, he had no reason to be there. He was heading there to fix the pipeline. And he was hit by a negligently operated train of the indemnity.
It's hard to find very many factual similarities in that case. And this is an agreement between two transportation companies. And the business of Greyhound is depositing passengers. It's very hard for me to believe that UTA didn't expect to be covered for harm that would arise out of the presence of those customers on the property.
And that's a secondary issue, Your Honor, because no party has argued ambiguity in this agreement that wasn't addressed by the trial court. So the only way that we can derive the party's
intent... Well, what I'm saying is that the construction of the phrase arise from or arise out of will differ by context, and that the Union Pacific case may not cover this case.
And I think to add to that, we're not just talking about use here. It's even occupancy, just by arising out of their being there, occupancy. And you know, that seems to suggest something more in the nature, or at least to me, of premises liability.
Your Honor, I would again just direct the court back to the well-recognized principles of the law that as a contracting party and as a tenant, Greyhound was always allowed to rely on UTA to perform its obligations under the lease and to not be negligent. It represented in the lease agreement affirmatively that it was providing a physical premises that complied with building code, that complied with the Americans with Disabilities Act, that would not pose a hazard.
Well, you represented, your client represented that it would not be negligent, right?
I believe that both
in the
sides.
Indemnification.
Both
you,
sides.
You represented that, yet you bought insurance for yourself, right?
We bought insurance to cover instances where Greyhound's conduct might give rise to a claim. The contract
well,
never...
Wouldn't this H1 cover, don't you concede that it covers your client in the event of your client's negligence?
I believe that that agreement is intended to cover claims asserted against UTA that arise from Greyhound's negligence, which is not the case with respect to this claim. And whether or not it would cover my client is really immaterial to the issues pending before this court, whether my client breached the contract.
It's material to the question of whether the fact that you have a separate indemnity agreement means that you could not have, that this could not have included insurance as well.
It may well, if a policy had been procured or in a self-insured capacity, whether Greyhound would pay its own claims or whether an insurer would pay its claims, that falls directly within the plain language of paragraph 10H1, because if the claim arose from Greyhound's fault or negligence, then clearly it would be something that arises from its use, occupancy, maintenance, or operations. The example I would like to give the court is perhaps an outrageous example, but I believe that there are so many different facts, circumstances that could potentially arise within contracts where the language arising from might come into play. If Ms. Bradley had been at the intermodal hub and an employee of UTA, an aggrieved employee who happened to be there had gone out and shot her to death, would that be said to have arisen from Greyhound's use, occupancy, maintenance, and operations? At some point, the language has to be construed to be something more than but-for cause and something less
well,
than
cause. Counsel, how should I read this? It says commercial general liability with landlord named as an additional insured. Who's the first insured?
I believe that Greyhound, had it procured a policy, which it was not required to do, would be the named insured on that policy. So it would cover Greyhound's actions, and that's
okay.
Exactly what we're arguing.
And your example, the problem with your example, of course, is that it involves an intentional act, not negligence. I mean, somebody who was accidentally shot would be in the same position as somebody who accidentally slipped and fell.
And I respectfully disagree, Your Honor, for the reason that UTA expressly undertook certain obligations
yes.
in this agreement.
Yes.
And that's a different
got that point.
It's a different circumstance. And as you pointed out to the court, in effect, the interpretation that's being urged by UTA is asking the court to find that all responsibility, all liability for its breaches of the lease agreement, for its negligence, be shifted onto UTA. And that's why we've urged that a rule of strict construction applies. In fact, this has not only been an issue within the context of this case, but ongoing in terms of UTA's failure to perform snow removal obligations.
Well, but you can do the snow removal and send a bill under paragraph 28, I think, or 30. I mean, that's a different problem, it seems to me.
And
you say it's been shifted onto Greyhound, but if that's what the contract provides, Greyhound's got the option to buy insurance and agreed to it, if that's the way we interpret the contract.
It may have the option. Greyhound could have the option to go procure insurance that goes well beyond what it is contractually obligated to do.
Would you acknowledge that we wouldn't be here but for Greyhound's decision to self-insure? That if you had gone out and obtained a CGL policy from a third party, in the real world, we wouldn't be having this dispute?
I disagree, Your Honor, because if my client had gone to a third-party liability insurer and said, this is a limitation, we are only asking for insurance that covers our use, occupancy, maintenance, and operation.
No, that it has the exact, it goes back to Justice Lee's question at the beginning, that has the exact same language in the clause that we're dealing with, not as it's construed by you, but the same language. It arises from use and occupancy.
And again, Your Honor, I agree that Ms. Bradley, but for her customer relationship with Greyhound, would not have been there.
I think what Justice Lee was getting at earlier is if you had just got the commercial liability policy, given the way courts have construed that language in those policies, in the real world, we're not here, right?
No, Your Honor, I disagree because in that event, it would be the insurer standing here in my position arguing that where the claim was due to their sole admitted negligence and their breach of the lease agreement, it did not arise from the use of...
Don't parties insure themselves against their own negligence all the time?
Yes, Your Honor, and if this agreement were phrased differently, to state expressly that the insurance obligation encompassed UTA's negligence, it encompassed their breach of its lease undertakings, it encompassed all of their activities and the things they promised to do in this agreement, then that would be a different situation. And I see that my time is up, Your Honors. I would ask that the court reverse the summary judgment. Paragraph 10H does not require insurance for claims other than claims arising from use, occupancy, and maintenance, which this claim did not. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel. We'll take this matter under advisement. At this point, we're going to take a brief recess, after which we will hear the case of Davis and Sanchez versus University of Utah Healthcare. Thank you.